Okay, so who are you?
My name is Alfred Hitchcock.
So why have you decided to be on the podcast?
This was meant for your listening pleasure, and I hope you like it.
So is this like a private comment, or am I able to publish it?
Anyone may listen. We have no intention to discriminate.
Okay, this is getting a little bit worrying because A, you've been dead since 1980, and secondly, you're talking about yourself in the third person, and that does come across as just a little bit pretentious.
I hope you listen closely.
Of course I'm fucking going to listen closely. You're Alfred Hitchcock, you've been dead for a long time, and you're talking on my podcast. Why the fuck would I not listen closely?
There is a lack of certain bodily comforts.
Yeah, I know, we don't have a fucking B-Day, and you wrote that into your rider. So I'm sorry, we don't have a B-Day, and you can stop using stupid little euphemisms like bodily comforts, all right?
We keep losing listeners.
Listen, you fat pommy wanker. For a start, if you look at the stats on Podbean, we are not losing listeners. What we've done is we've now got half as many episodes each month. Therefore, we've actually gained listeners over the period of the last 12 months. So shut your fucking neck.
I hope that as you listen to this, you are among your loved ones.
You really know absolutely nothing about a podcast audience. Most of the people that listen to this stuff are either shut-ins or they're people who have immensely long commutes and are fed up with what right-wing radio. So if you just paid attention, you'd know that we are not with our loved ones when we listen to Paleo Cinema podcasts. Most of the time we're either on the road, we're waiting for dialysis, or we're masturbating.
Adults will not be permitted to listen unless they are accompanied by their children.
Okay, now you're getting really fucking weird and I'm getting a bit scared here. You don't have to have a kid with you to listen to the podcast. In fact, it's recommended that you don't. You're going to really fuck with the kid's head when we start mentioning Barbara Hershey naked when I talk about Boxcar Bertha. And also, we're talking about Stella Stevens' breasts when I talk about Slaughter this time. So just don't go there and stop putting stupid, unenforceable, draconian demands upon the audience, all right?
If you're with your wife, show her how you feel about her. In simple, homey places like the kitchen table or the bathtub.
Okay, so now you're giving the audience sexual advice about where to fuck their wives. Basically, don't do that. There are women who listen to it. Some of them don't have wives. And by the way, yes, in the 21st century, women can get married in a lot of places. Not here, but in a lot of places. So basically, that's it, Alfred. You're out of it until the end of the podcast. Fuck off. Listen. Do whatever you like. Wank off to pictures of Tippi Hedren. Just go away for now, will you? And by the way, everybody, welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema is a four-weekly podcast which looks at and recommends movies that are more than 20 years old. The good, the obscure, the interesting, and the weird. Feedback is important. You can email it to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. Visit the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook or leave a recorded voicemail or comment at paleocinema.blogspot.com or drop a voicemail at our new number 206-309-4864. This podcast may contain adult concepts and language, but please don't be disappointed if it doesn't.
Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 116. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, I'm going way back into my early life, and I'm going to be reviewing the first two R-rated movies I ever saw. I saw them in a cinema. So the movies themselves are Scorsese's second film, Boxcar Bertha, starring Barbara Hershey and David Carradine, and also our great blaxploitation film, Slaughter, with Jim Brown, Rip Torn, Stella Stevens, and Don Gordon. So, how has everybody been? It's been wet and cold here, which is not the experience that I know a lot of listeners are having. But, you know, me in winter, it's not my best time of year. I really want global warming, but I only want it within a 100-kilometre radius of where I live. Everywhere else I want some kind of homeostasis, nice predictable temperature ranges during the season, but where I live in the wintertime, I want things to be tropical. Now, this is a totally unrealistic expectation. It's simply not going to happen, but it's what I want. Now, having said that, the sound quality you might hear is slightly better this time around. The reason for that is my old Microsoft Live Chat microphone went to Jesus, well, stepped on a rainbow, and the sound quality was diminishing over the last couple of podcasts, and I do apologise for that. I've now got myself a replacement one. They're a good little podcasting mic, those ones. The Live Chat 3000s, I think it is. And always good for a bit of headset action. And I'm quite glad that I upgraded it, because there's nothing worse than wrestling with audio issues with a podcast. You're trying to concentrate on the content. You're trying to get out there the message you want to send. And meanwhile, in the background, you're fucking around with levels and noise reduction filters and all sorts of weird and horrible shit that really takes away from what you're trying to do with a podcast. So I'm glad I upgraded that this morning, and I did get another mic, which I'm taking back, and I've got to really kind of do a product consumer affairs thing with this one. Never buy a microphone and headset from a brand called Plantronics. I've bought it, I upgraded all of the drivers, and the sound quality is still guano. Really a poor quality product. It's the same price as this one that I've got and I'm using now, but I was getting a lot of background noise and all sorts of weird shit I couldn't get rid of. So I'm taking that one back, and really, don't bother. Plantronics, your products suck, and I think that you're not maybe giving people best value for their dollars. So what have I been watching? I've got my Mizzo up already, because I anticipated this question I was going to ask myself. And I did see Soderbergh's movie Behind the Candelabra, the Liberace biopic that he did recently with Michael Douglas, he of the Gamma Hutching Cancer, and also Matt Damon. And I like it. I think it works really well. It's a well put together piece. I don't think it's really a commercial film in any way, apart from certain nightclubs in Oxford Street, Sydney, and maybe Commercial Road, South Yarra in Melbourne. But, yeah, it's interesting. Two straight actors playing two gay, or at least one of them says he's bisexual, real-life characters. Michael Douglas is very, very good as Liberace. He has the camp right. He has the fact that the guy is 99% of the time always on. And he has that kind of closeted secret life and the justifications that the man had for his behaviours and the way he treated other people. It really is an interesting one. I mean, I do want to, though, and this is purely a heterosexual thing, want to get the image of Matt Damon butt-fucking Michael Douglas out of my head. So one bit of it that I kind of went, no, I don't want to remember that, but I can't not remember it. It's a bit like the first time you see Goatsy. But having said that, it's a good film, very fine acting. Debbie Reynolds is in it playing Liberace's mum, which is kind of cool. And I think it's got very good period style to it, and it does entertain. It is kind of like a gay version of the Eddie Duchin story with Tyrone Power. But having said, and cross with Boogie Nights and cross with Brokeback Mountain. But, yeah, check it out. I like Soderbergh stuff. Even a bad Soderbergh movie is more interesting than a lot of the stuff you'll see out there. So it's worth checking out. I'm going to mention two other films that I've seen lately. I saw Gambit, the Coen Brothers written remake of the old Michael Caine, Shirley MacLaine movie from the 1960s. Alan Rickman's very good in it. Colin Firth doing the kind of role Hugh Grant used to do. Not so much. They went with predictable casting by putting Cameron Diaz in there, but that doesn't enhance anything. It doesn't add anything. It's a bit ordinary. You can watch it if you just want to have something the equivalent of mental bubblegum for a couple of hours, but I wouldn't particularly highly recommend it. I also saw the Peter Jackson, the first of the three Hobbit movies. Now, I've never been as in love with his Tolkien adaptations as a lot of other people are. I couldn't get into reading the books. They're not my kind of thing. I'm a little bit harder edged in the kind of stuff I like to read. None of the characters in The Hobbit engage me at all. Bilbo Baggins, a bit ordinary, just a kind of wussy little... He's like an English guy living in a little suburb who suddenly goes to war, which of course was Tolkien's experience during World War One. We know that, and we know that there are parallels there. But the way that Jackson puts it across by making what's essentially a fairly small story, trying to give it that epic grandeur, even though he does fight a dragon and nicks a ring from Gollum and all the other kind of stuff. Really, there's nothing there that is new. We've seen it all in the Lord of the Rings stuff, and it's only for diehard Tolkien junkies, I think, and SCA members. Not my kind of thing at all, and I am glad that I got the Blu-ray secondhand really cheaply, rather than paying full price for it. But I've seen it now, and I don't need particularly to see it again. I think as far as the visuals are concerned, it was spectacular, but there's something at the heart of it that Peter Jackson wasn't able to bring about. Maybe it's the John Carter phenomenon, where the original source material has been stolen from so many times by other filmmakers, that seeing the original story told on the screen lacks punch because we've seen it all before somewhere else. Maybe that's the issue with that film. But people who like that sort of thing are going to go see it, and I'm sure the second and the third ones are going to be spectacularly successful, even though there does seem to be a bit of a weird backlash against there being a female elf character put into the ensemble in the second film. I'm not entirely sure why, but apparently that's considered a bad thing. But I've watched a few other things, but nothing really spectacular. I'm up to 199 films this year. And the 200th film is going to be the second film I talk about in this podcast, because I'm going to go away having done this intro and watch it. And that is Slaughter with Jim Brown. So that's going to be my 200th film for the year. So I'm going to take a break now, go and watch Slaughter. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about an interesting Martin Scorsese film that gets dropped off everyone's Scorsese radar a little bit, because they tend to think that his career started with Mean Streets. And that film is Boxcar Bertha.
It's sad to think we're not gonna make it, and it's getting to the point where we just can't fake it. 'Cause for some ungodly reason, we just won't let it die. Because neither one of us wants to be the first to say goodbye. Get in my way. to saying goodbye. That's a one word I just can't
That was Linda George with Neither One of Us from 1973. And there's a reason I'm playing that, and there's a reason why 1973 is kind of crucial to this podcast. 1973 is the year that I discovered I could get sneak into, well, 1972 really, but 1972, 1973, we'll stretch a point here, was the year that I found out I could sneak into R-rated movies. Now, normally, you couldn't get into them unless you were 18, and there was some way you had to prove identity. I didn't have a driver's license until I was 43, so it wasn't really, well, no, 46, sorry. So there wasn't really a chance of me having any kind of ID anyway. So here's what I did. And the two movies I was trying to sneak in to see at the time at the Regal Cinema in Sydney, which people who are on my Facebook would find out, I've posted pictures of the cinema. It was my local flea pit for a lot of years. So the two movies I was going to see were Boxcar Bertha and Slaughter. And I wanted to see the movies. I wanted to see a good blaxploitation film. I'd just seen Shaft and I kind of liked that. So I really wanted to go there. And so I decided I was going to try to age up before I went to the cinema. And the only way I had of doing that was splashing Brute aftershave over myself. So what I did was I tried to look taller than I was. And I'm not short. I mean, I'm 6 foot. But I was trying to look a bit taller. I walked up to the little box office window. This is an old style single screen cinema, so it had a little box office window. And I walked up to there and put my money on the little brass plate there and said to the guy, "One ticket please," in a very deep voice. The guy didn't even look up from his newspaper and just gave me a ticket. This was the coolest thing that can happen to a 15-year-old boy, because it meant I could get in to see any movie in that cinema in spite of the government regulations saying that you had to be 18 to see a certain kind of film. Now, the R rating had started about a year or so before the Conservative government, just before Gough Whitlam got in. The Conservative government put in laws for R ratings. They needed to change the ratings. There are a lot of films that were being forbidden from being shown in Australia, and a lot of the people doing film festivals were having trouble getting films into Australia. So they put through a law with the R rating in there. Had to be 18 to get in, and they then had a way to moderate the censorship in order to let people see a certain kind of film if they're above a certain age. The first film to get an R rating was McCabe and Mrs. Miller, the Robert Altman film. Not all of the films that got it in the year after that were of that quality. The people managing the film companies, the film distribution companies, Hoyts and Greater Union, were the two big ones in Australia at the time, and to a certain extent still are. They decided, great, we can show tits. So what they did was they got a whole bunch of exploitation films from various other countries, dubbed them, and kind of went to town with it. I remember there were movies like Dagmar's Hot Pants Incorporated and Bedroom Mazurka, both of which were kind of Swedish sex comedies with a bit of nudity in them. They were very kind of soft core, but immensely popular. I remember seeing Dagmar's Hot Pants at a tiny little community cinema in Morisset when I was up on the Central Coast for holidays. And it was really popular. People wanted to go and see the titty films. And so they did. So this is the reason why, getting back to the subject, I wanted to do Boxcar Bertha and Slaughter in a podcast. They were the two first R-rated movies I got to see, which had that extra frisson of being illegal for me to see them. So I've seen the movies again. I hadn't seen Boxcar Bertha since 1972. And I hadn't seen Slaughter for a number of years as well. And it was really nice revisiting him. I didn't know Scorsese from A Loaf of Bread at the time I saw Boxcar Bertha. But I know more about him now, of course, and his documentaries, particularly about American cinema and Italian cinema, have taught me a lot about cinema, and I really do appreciate them. So there's a continuity there from my very first adult cinema-going experience had Martin Scorsese in it. It continues to this very day in certain ways. So I'm just going to start off with Boxcar Bertha because that's the way they played. They played Boxcar Bertha first, and then they played Slaughter after the interval in the evening session. And that's when they showed two movies back-to-back. Those were the good old days of single-screen cinemas where you got to see two movies for your money rather than just one.
Boxcar Bertha and her boys took what they wanted.
Now, 50s. It's 50.
Meet Boxcar Bertha, queen of the gun-toters.
Ooh, impatience, please.
I think we got them.
Here he is, right here.
That's it, that's it.
Yeah. Lady would like to say something.
Yes, I'd just like to say, this is a holdup.
Bertha was a fun-loving gal.
Stand up. Sit down. Close your eyes and open your mouth. Now, don't move.
She had a taste for loving and an empty boxcar for a boudoir.
I've been lots of places.
You ever been with a man?
America in the 30s was a free country. Bertha was just a little bit freer than most. Big Bill Shelley was a man fighting all the wrongs in the world.
We're gonna grind him in the gravel!
Vaughn was a mystery man, an armed talker. He was a doer. Bertha and her gang made a name for themselves with the police, but the newspapers were too polite to print it.
Hi. You're coming with us.
Robert, Billy Boy, don't make me do what I want to do.
Run, Bertha!
Okay, Boxcar Bertha, and this is from Wikipedia, is a 1972 movie directed by Martin Scorsese. It was made for American International Pictures when Roger Corman was producing then, and it was made for $600,000. This was Scorsese's first colour film, and it was his second feature film, the first one being a movie he made in 1967 called Who's That Knocking at My Door? It's also called I Call First, which he did with Harvey Keitel. So basically 5 years later, after he made that film, he was given a chance to make a film by Roger Corman, and indeed he did. There's a little bit of audio from YouTube with Julie Corman and Roger Corman and Martin Scorsese talking about how Boxcar Bertha came about.
Boxcar Bertha was the first picture that Julie worked on with me as co-producer.
I met him, and he said, look, I have a sequel to Bloody Mama. It's called Boxcar Bertha. Would you be interested in doing it? I said, absolutely. You know, and Bloody Mama actually had De Niro in it. See?
By the time we got to Camden, Arkansas,
Marty had sketched every shot of the picture, which was all over the walls of his motel room.
I took out all these drawings, about 500, and he looked at the first 20 or 30 or something, and then he looked, he said, did you do this for the entire picture? I said, yeah. He said, all right. He put it away, and he left.
Yeah, so Scorsese basically storyboarded an entire Roger Corman exploitation film, which shows that the guy had guts and he wanted to make a good film. It was, in a sense, a calling card for him. Now, the plot, and I'm getting this again from Wikipedia, it's based on an original story written in Sisters of the Road, tells the story of Bertha Thompson, played by Barbara Hershey, and Big Bill Shelley, played by David Carradine, two train robbers and lovers who are caught up in the plight of railroad workers in the American South. When Bertha is implicated in the murder of a wealthy gambler, well, basically she does shoot him, the pair become fugitives from justice. While the story adheres to certain conventions of exploitation narrative, it offers a surprisingly frank look at race and gender issues in the 1930s. And indeed it does, and it's got a great cast. You got Hershey and Carradine, of course. You got Barry Primus, a very underrated actor who's still a jobbing actor these days and has done a lot of teaching as well. He came from the Actors Studio as Rake Brown, who is a kind of northern New York boy gambler who gets involved with Bertha and Bill and tags along with them. And also you've got Bernie Casey, one of the best roles Bernie Casey did, as Von Morton, a big black railroad worker kind of guy who hooks up with them and becomes friendly with both Bertha and Bill over the period of the movie. You've also got a couple of jokes in the cast credits too. There's a couple of credits for Graham Pratt playing a character called Emmerich Pressburger and Chicken Holloman as M. Powell. They're just basically, they weren't actually in the movie. They were just Scorsese giving a nod to Powell and Pressburger just as a little bit of a gig. And yeah, the movie does hold up pretty well. It's very raw around the edges. There wasn't a lot of opportunity to do retakes and things like that in a $600,000 budget where most of the stuff, in fact, pretty much all of the stuff was done on location. And I like it. It's got that kind of exploitation rawness, but it's also got a few of Scorsese's tropes in it as well to keep things interesting. Now, of course, when I was 15, the attraction was the violence and the fact that Barbara Hershey gets barefoot all over a fair bit in this movie. There's a couple of passionate lovemaking scenes with David Carradine. Barbara Hershey and David Carradine were in a relationship at the time. So there's obviously kind of passion and tenderness in there. And it does play across the screen kind of well. And Barbara Hershey, who was never classically beautiful really, and she's 24 at the time of making the film, really does put across well a woman of the time. The interesting thing is, and I don't know whether this is deliberate or just the actors or just my hearing of it, they don't sound like 1970s Americans. They're very much the accents and the intonation and the choice of words is very much more of the 1930s, which is kind of cool, and it does give a lot of verisimilitude to this. It's really great. I mean, there are a couple of things I could quibble about. The fact that right at the start, as Bertha's father, who is a crop duster, pranks his aeroplane and dies, that's kind of handled a little bit crudely because they didn't have the budget to do it really well. But there's a bit with David Carradine and a couple of other guys nailing in railroad spikes into the sleepers on a railway, and David Carradine does not have the musculature of somebody who spends all day hammering iron spikes into a railroad. He looks more like a yoga instructor. But leaving those kind of things aside, which I always notice in movies for some reason, I mean, I grew up around, and at the time I saw this movie, I was working in factories. At the age of 15, I was working in factories around near Liverpool, New South Wales, for a long time. I did it for 4 or 5 years. And you don't stay without muscle tone very successfully if you're doing any kind of physical activity 8 or 10 hours a day. But leaving that aside, it does work well. There's a really nice thing after Bill first seduces Bertha. There's a really nice scene where she finds that he's left some money for her in his shoe, in her shoe as she dresses. And in a modern film, women would get offended by that. How dare he pay me for sex, all that kind of thing. But it doesn't play like that in this movie. Money is, it's during the Depression. Money is an important thing. And she just looks down at the money and smiles, which is a really interesting choice to make there. And is not one that would be made in a 21st century film either, which I kind of really like. And there are a couple of other scenes that really do have some lovely detail in it. There's a scene in a hobo jungle where there are families just living on the side of the railroad tracks in basically little sheds and little huts that they built themselves out of anything they can scrounge. There's a woman feeding a baby sitting outside one of these little huts, and she's feeding the baby milk from a soft drink bottle. Which is kind of cool. They used the soft drink bottle because that's what they would have used at the time to feed the baby milk. But it's one of those little details that you miss if you don't look for it. But I found it quite cool that they used things that way. And Scorsese does have a good period feel for the thing too. There's not one bit where I can see any anachronisms. I did look for them, but there's nothing at all in any way anachronistic in this film. A lot of it's filmed along an old railroad line in the south, and a lot of the stuff plays out in abandoned buildings. They're obviously on the run from the law for a great extent because of the robberies they do. And the kind of worn-out buildings that they hole up in really does kind of add to the feel of the thing, that's feel of decay and that feel of a society that's starting to break down because of the Depression and because of the economic hardships that occurred during the Depression. Now, there's also a couple of interesting choices too, where Bertha's kind of, Bill's not with her and she's kind of wandering around, and she's wanders into a town, she's dirty and she's hungry, and a woman says, have you got somewhere to stay? And she says, no. And she said, come with me. And the woman takes her to a brothel. And it turns out that she's the madam of the brothel. And the interesting choice in that part of it is that it's a community of women, and Bertha actually thrives in that environment. It's not a degradation thing. It's not perceived or portrayed as a degradation thing. It's portrayed as a valid choice for a single woman in the Depression who wants to remain independent and doesn't just want to hook up and marry a guy so she's got some kind of economic certainty to work in a brothel. And that's a kind of cool thing. I have a different cultural viewpoint than some other countries about this. We've had legalized prostitution in Australia for at least 20 years. When they say legalized, they say decriminalized because it's a softer sell to the conservatives. But yeah, since prostitution has been legalized, I'm not saying it's a perfect system. There are people who are exploited in it, but it's not perceived as pejorative. And I really shouldn't say prostitution either, because the preferred term these days is sex work. But it really does have a different viewpoint, and it's true to a viewpoint of the time that certain people had about the independence. And there's also a bit too where Bertha walks into a black juke joint kind of bar and sees Von there, and her and Von hug each other, and they're friendly with each other, even across the colour bar they had at the time. And as she walks in, everything goes silent until it's seen that she's one of Von's friends. And that's another interesting thing too, that the way the racial thing is handled in this movie. It's not a perfect film, and it's very raw Scorsese. You've got to remember, it's before Mean Streets. But I think it really does show a couple of things, one of which is Scorsese is brilliant, and he does know his stuff. And there are little homages in the film to films of the 1930s, for instance. You can find those out for yourself, but there are a couple of them there. And then, of course, there's a kind of foreshadowing of future Scorsese films in the way Big Bill Shelley ends up. And I'm not going to spoil that particularly. If you look up the movie at all on the internet, you probably find out what it is, but I'll let you find that out for yourself. But yeah, and it's a solid little film. It runs 88 minutes. Budget, as I said, $600,000. But it works. It's not perfect, and it's a little choppy at times. There's a few discontinuities in the editing and things like that, which, of course, never stopped a Roger Corman movie. But I do like it, and I'm kind of glad that I waited to revisit it after so long. And what was it? It's been 40 years since I saw the film, which in itself is scary, but I think that I appreciate different things in the film that I did when I first saw it. I'm not as enamored of and surprised by and extremely titillated by female nudity the way I was at those stages. Not that I particularly slowed down much, it's just that I've seen so much more of it than I had at the time. And at the time, it was incredibly erotic to see Barbara Hershey naked in the film. But these days, nudity is almost everywhere if you look for it. In fact, you can pull it out of the air, literally, with your computer. But having said that, I think it's a film to watch and a film to enjoy. And I don't think there's anything in there that Martin Scorsese should be ashamed of. It's really a fine piece of exploitation cinema and part of that continuity of one of the great filmmakers of the last 50 years. So I'm going to take a little bit of a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about, to be honest with you, a lesser film, being Slaughter, directed by Jack Starrett and starring Jim Brown, Rip Torn, Stella Stevens, and Don Gordon.
Slaughter. Slaughter. It's not only his name, it's his business, and sometimes his pleasure. Slaughter. The Fuzz wanted him alive for a murder rap. The mob wanted him dead for insurance. She wanted him healthy for personal reasons. And that's only for openers. Slaughter. He had a belly gun, four grenades, an automatic rifle, and a theory. The best defense is to attack. See Slaughter. Starring Jim Brown, Stella Stevens, Rip Torn, and Cameron Mitchell. An American international picture rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parents. Slaughter.
Baddest cat that ever walked the earth.
Why aren't people called cats anymore? I think it's cool to call someone a cat. There was a bit conflicted because when cat came along as a cool thing to say, it kind of conflicted with the Australian slang of my parents' era. In early mid-20th century Australian working class criminal subculture slang, a cat was a gay guy, and it was considered a pejorative term at the time. So when I heard people started talking about cool cats, I was kind of conflicted because the slang of my father in particular kind of conflicted with that in a weird way. But leaving that aside, we've got on to Slaughter, 1972 kind of blaxploitation movie with Jim Brown, who, as Americans know, and I'll just kind of cater to the sports jocks here, he had a record-setting nine-year career as a running back for the Cleveland Browns from 57 to 65, never out with an injury. Okay, so that keeps you sports fans happy. Got you out of my way now. Now, the film kind of is fun. It's incredibly raw. It was directed by Jack Starrett, who was an actor and director who did a lot of exploitation work. If you remember in Blazing Saddles, the guy who plays Gabby Johnson, you can't understand what he is, what he's saying. He's the old panhandler kind of guy with no teeth and a beard like a toilet brush, gumming away at his words. That's Jack Starrett. But he did also direct a number of things, particularly for television. Now, Slaughter had a bigger budget than Boxcar Bertha. It was $750,000, and it made $10 million in the box office, so they definitely got their bait back on this film. It's a pretty simple plot, but I'll kind of tick it off just to get it done. And again, this is from the Wikipedia. Let's have a look here. The plot is basically an ex-Vietnam vet and ex-Green Beret Captain Slaughter, played by Jim Brown. His parents are blown up by a car bomb. It's revealed that they were killed off by the mafia. His father was a computer guy, and the mafia was computerizing their businesses and moving their data onto great big punch cards and computers. And he found out that they were actually the mafia, and so they blew him up. So Slaughter goes on a rampage and decides to kill off all the people who killed his parents. He does. He has a great shootout at an airport. The cops catch him, but a guy played by Cameron Mitchell. I'm just trying to think of the guy's name. I'll find the guy's name here. Here we go. Price. Cameron Mitchell has one scene basically playing Price. He says to him, one of these guys, Dominic Hoff, and also the head of the mafia group, Mario Felice, are in a South American country. If you go down and, you know, take care of them and or keep them busy and investigate while we get our shit together to arrest them and bring them back, we'll rip up the paper on the fact that you blew up an aeroplane and killed off a few people at an airport. Again, you know, logic and common sense isn't a big part of this film. So he says yes, and along with, he flies down there. In the meantime, he's been hassled by someone who says they're a journalist, Marlena Clark's character, Kim. Now, she's an attractive woman, a woman of colour, and she's kind of playing it, and she doesn't get a lot to do in this film. She had better things to do in a couple of other films, and she was interviewed for Machete Maidens Unleashed for some of the Roger Corman exploitation films that she did at around this time. She was married at one stage to Billy Dee Williams for a couple of years as well, but she's in there and kind of has a little bit of fun and a few moments of nudity, which are interesting. And when they get down to Mexico, they meet up with the other person Price has hired. His name is Frank, and he's played by Don Gordon. Now, Don Gordon was an actor. You've seen him in Twilight Zone episodes. He was a jobbing actor through a whole bunch of the 60s and 70s and 80s. You'll know the face when you see him. And he's playing the comic relief in this film, but he does have some good, cool action scenes along with Jim Brown in this. Now, when they get down there, Felice, played by a guy who only ever made this film because he's a bad actor, called Norman Ollery, basically says to Dominic Hoff, played by Rip Torn, and he's playing this as a seedy, weedy, really nasty piece of work. His girlfriend, Anne, played by Stella Stevens, who's not actually his girlfriend, but a sex slave they got when she was very young, as it turns out. They say, well, you go up and kind of sidle up to Slaughter and keep him busy and tell us anything he tells you. Of course she does. And falls in love with him, as you do. And it all kind of progresses from there. Now, having said that, there's a couple of pluses and a couple of minuses of this film. Well, there are several pluses and several minuses. The minuses I'll get out of the way first, then I'll talk about the pluses. Jim Brown is basically phoning it in the dialogue scenes of this film. He really does. There's a bit where a friend of his, who's a friend of his parents, is machine gunned through a bedroom window, through a lounge room window, sorry, by the mafia guys. And Jim Brown has a no reaction to it at all, really. He goes through the motions and does what they tell him to do physically, but there's no emotional content at all, the fact that he's just seen a woman machine gunned in the guts by the mafia. And he really, it's just like, what the fuck? You can at least try. But he doesn't really. He picks up a bit later in the movie. I don't know, maybe he had a stomach upset that day or something, but later in the film he does that kind of thing a lot better. But right at the start, that kind of him getting up to speed slows the film down a lot. And the fact that he's just got no emotional reaction at all to the fact that his parents got blown up in the car, apart from having a stony face. There's kind of nothing behind the stony face and the kind of stiff body. But he loosens up. There's a number of good action scenes in this film, and Jim Brown is great at that. They give him one of the things he does best in action scenes, something that a much shorter and less interesting actor, Tom Cruise, does as well. They get him to run a lot. As you might remember from The Dirty Dozen, there's that bit where he runs across the rooftop of the German chateau, dropping grenades down the ventilation shafts as he goes. That kind of running. And he does it really well. There's a couple of really nice action sequences, one of which involves Slaughter walking through a Mexican town at night. It's actually set in Mexico and filmed in Mexico, but it's set in a name of the South American country because the Mexican authorities didn't like the fact that Mexico might have some kind of mafia involvement. But, and basically he's walking down the streets in this small, the back streets of a Mexican, a kind of South American town, let's say. And some people try to run him down repeatedly with a car, and he's running and dodging and shooting back at them and, you know, rolling over the bonnet of the car and having a lot to do with that. There's a couple of scenes where it could have been a stuntman, but for the most part, it is Jim Brown doing the action sequences, and it works really, really well. He's got, when he's in motion and when there's an action scene, you understand why the guy's in movies. The physicality of him is impressive. And he was in great shape at the time. It probably still is for a guy his age. But really, his body brings its A game, but his mind doesn't particularly in this film, which I kind of like. Because once he gets in motion, it becomes interesting. And there's another scene where he has a fight with three guys on the rooftop, one of which is played by a character actor that you will have seen in the kind of late 1960s and 1970s, like a guy with the undistinguished name of Robert Phillips. He's the guy with the Anton Chigurh hairdo and the mean little mustache. And he's quite a muscular and fit guy himself and plays off well against Jim Brown in this. And there's a scene with him having a fight with a knife with Jim Brown and with a couple of other guys on the roof of a building, which kind of plays out pretty well. And there's a great big gunfight involving Don Gordon and Jim Brown against the bad guys, which kind of works really well because, again, that kind of pure physicality does really play well. Jim Brown is... You also got some kind of good music by Lucho de Jesus, who's the guy who did the music in this. But the theme music, the theme song from Slaughter, and you've got to have one of those ever since Isaac Hayes first won the Academy Award for Shaft. You've got to have a decent song in a blaxploitation film. And this one's by Billy Preston. I kind of like it. I think it stands up pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that kind of gives you the movie in a nutshell there. Rip Torn in this one plays an unredeemably nasty character. He's venal, he's racist to the max. He sees he sees the Ann character played by Stella Stevens as property. He's got greasy, lank, balding hair. There's nothing at all likable in any way about him. And if you have a look at the legal troubles that the actor himself has had, he maybe wasn't playing too far from himself in some ways. He has been known to be incredibly difficult to work with at various times. And I think part of it's got to be the fact that his real first name is Elmore. That's really got to fuck somebody up. But, he's what brings to it what it needs for this kind of film. And you need a bad guy who's unredeemably nasty and dark and will do anything to anybody if it suits him. And Torn indeed does that. He's a good actor. If you've seen Payday, you know that he's a good actor. But in this one, he overacts at times, and at other times he kind of underacts a little bit, which is kind of a weird choice. But nonetheless, he's very memorable in this film. And Stella Stevens, she was 36 at the time, and has a couple of nude scenes as well as a few bikini scenes, which I found intensely erotic at the time I first saw this film. And I still find her to be what the English people call well fit. And indeed she is. I've kind of had a bit of a run of Stella Stevens at the moment because I saw her in an earlier film recently, a very early Cassavetes film called Too Late Blues, where she starred opposite Bobby Darin playing his girlfriend. And she's a fine actor. If you haven't seen Too Late Blues, it's not major Cassavetes, and it is just him finding his feet with his style of filmmaking, but it's worth checking out, and a nice, very low budget, but interesting film. And it does highlight the fact that Stella Stevens can definitely act. And in this one, too, she's, even though she's in, to a disheartening extent, the victim of a number of different men, not including the hero, of course, she does very well, and she brings a greater emotional range to that role than it may be needed. So she's definitely brought her A game to it, and it's a shame that she wasn't better respected during her active career as an actress, because she could definitely bring the chops. I was a bit surprised to see her naked when I first saw the film as well, because the previous film I'd seen her in was The Nutty Professor with Jerry Lewis, and she played a very much different role in that. But having said that, this is a good, honest 1970s exploitation movie. And it's very much of its time. There was a sequel, Slaughter's Big Ripoff, which is kind of interesting, and I'm going to have to revisit pretty soon after I finish recording this podcast, in fact. That one has a cast that you really like. The bad guy is played by Ed McMahon, the sidekick guy from Johnny Carson's got Don Stroud in it, Brock Peters, Gloria Hendry, and it was directed by Gordon Douglas, which is kind of cool, and I'm sure it's a much better film than Slaughter. I'll let you know what I think when I rewatched it, because there's another one I haven't watched for a very long time. But there's something about seeing one blaxploitation movie. It's a bit like Peanuts. You can't stop at one. You've got to see a few more before you're satisfied. And in fact, I will. Now, I'm going to take another break. And when I get back, I'm going to do the feedback. Now, the second song I'm going to play, apart from the Slaughter one, I'm keeping in tune with the 1970s vibe.
Western Bay, and it serves 100 ships a day. Lonely sailors pass the time away and talk about their homes. And there's a girl in this harbor town, and she works laying whiskey down. They say brandy
fetch another round. She serves them whiskey and wine. They say the same brand new. You're a fine girl. There's a braided chain made of finest silver from the north of Spain. A locket that bears the name of a man that Brandy loved. He came on a summer's day bringing gifts from far away. But he made it clear he couldn't stay. No harbor was his home. The sailor said, Brandy, down. Brandy walks through a silent town and loves a man who's not around. She still can hear him say, she hears him say, Brandy, you're a fine girl.
That was Looking Glass with Brandy, which you'll also find on the soundtrack album for Anchorman, the movie with Will Ferrell in it. So on to the feedback.
Hey, Terry, this is Richard from Wichita. I will apologize up front at the quality of this voicemail message. I am calling from my cell phone in my car. Yes, I'm on the road, and that seems to be the only time I call you. But you know what? For whatever reason, I've always got the Paleo Cinema or Mars and Drive-In podcast one or two behind, and as I'm heading down to Oklahoma to I'm not in Oklahoma. As I'm leaving this message, I'm in Southeast Kansas. I have already been to Bartlesville, Oklahoma. My mom and dad are moving. This has been a journey, a long journey for the last several months, but the truck is loaded, it's on its way, and as I'm calling you, I am following my mom and dad, and we are driving our way up to Topeka, Kansas. So they're 81, and it was time to move them close to family, so no more trips to Oklahoma. They are 2 hours away now instead of three, and it is straight interstate, so a much quicker and easier drive, and they will be 7 minutes away from my sister and her husband. So, and a much smaller house, but maintenance-free, basically, so a good situation. So anyway, that's why I'm calling you. I'm in Southeast Kansas and you are keeping me sane. Moving 81-year-old parents, I don't recommend it for anybody. Any case, loving the episodes as always. You know, you're making some random comments about recent movies, Iron Man 3, Star Trek Into Darkness. Obviously I'm a little behind on movies. I've seen those two. I have not yet seen Fast and Furious 6, which I want to. I've heard Hangover Part 3 is horrible. Not a surprise there. Waiting for DVD on that. I guess the next big movie I'm going to be seeing, besides Fast and Furious 6, which, I mean, that's just mindless action. I love the first five. I heard the sixth one's the best. It's cars. Blowing shit up. Come on. That's fun stuff. Man of Steel. I guess we're about a week away from that. I'm looking forward to that. In fact, my blog, monstermoviekid.wordpress.com, has been kind of on hold the last couple of weeks as my life has been crazy, but I'm starting up again this next week with the Krypton Countdown. Going to be doing a revisit of the Superman franchise, Superman the movie, Superman 2, 3, and 4, Superman Returns, that should be fun, and then Man of Steel. So that's going to start up again next week. But, you know, so some random comments on Iron Man 3. I liked it. Not my favorite of the Iron Man franchise. Yeah, you know, it's had a hard act to follow up. Come on, it's not gonna be as good as the Avengers. But I thought that it picked up on some themes pretty well. I mean, the fact that Tony Stark is essentially damaged after his experiences in the Avengers, that totally makes sense. That works. This is a story that probably would have been better told in a comic book. As a movie, it falls a little flat. You know, the Mandarin wasn't going to work as it was originally written in the comics in this day and age. You know, not quite happy what they did with the Mandarin, but it was okay. With that said, I like the movie. Just because it's not my favorite of the franchise doesn't mean I didn't enjoy it. Star Trek Into Darkness, I liked it. You know, it's not Star Trek like I grew up with. It's a lot less cerebral. It is more action-oriented. People are going to shit on it no matter what. Long-time Trek fans are going to have problems with it. You know, I guess I approach it a little bit better or easier in the fact that I turn my brain off. I enjoy it. I know that it's not classic Trek. It's not replacing classic Trek, but it is still Star Trek in my mind. It's still fun. I agree with you, Chris Pine. Not quite sure where we stand on him. Zachary Quinto is amazing. Benedict Cumberbatch was amazing. Carl Urban is still Dr. McCoy in my mind, even though he didn't have as much to do here. I'm still not 100% sold on Simon Pegg. He's a little goofy for my taste, but he is still good as Scotty. So, you know, outside of about 10 minutes where they're doing the warp core issue, I'm not going to go into spoiler territory, but yeah, it was pretty much verbatim from another movie, and I had a problem with that. I thought that was lazy writing. I think they should have done something better. And the emotional impact isn't anywhere close to what we saw in an earlier film. So, besides that, I was okay with the character of Benedict Cumberbatch. I was okay with that. In fact, he kicked ass. So, you know, sometimes you just got to go into these movies and just say, I want to turn my brain off and enjoy it. In other movies, you expect something from it. I guess that's kind of why I can find something enjoyable in most everything I watch. You are watching a shitload of movies this year, far surpassing me. I love hearing you talk about what movies you're watching. Loving the show as always. And I'm just going to go ahead and leave that as it is. Looks like we're coming up to a stop on the road here, so I'm going to have to stop. But take care. Loving the show. Thank you for continuing to put this out in the Martian Drive-In. In fact, I am getting ready to listen to Martian Drive-In podcast right now. With that, take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks again, Richard. I always like your voicemails on the road. They're always a bit of fun. Yeah, not into the Fast and Furious movies. I haven't seen any of them. Sal saw one of them by accident at a work function. But for me, it's just like Top Gear on Red Bull. So I'm not really going to go there. I may at some stage digest a lot of them in one go, as I'm prone to do at times. But at the moment, they're not on my radar at all. Man of Steel, I've been hearing mixed things about. I'm really not too sure how that's going to play out eventually. I think Zack Snyder's interesting visual stylist, but I'm not sure that when he comes to the heart of a character, he's got really what it takes. I mean, I probably will go to see Man of Steel. In fact, I know I am going to, just after I check out World War Z, and yes, I said Z to piss off people, which I'm going to see with a bunch of work colleagues, so we'll check that out and get a little bit of zombie action happening, and then move on to Man of Steel with other friends a little bit later. As far as the old Superman movies are concerned, I think they've dated horribly. And I know that that's a bit of a heretical statement to make. But I think, you know, people are going, well, it was a more innocent time. We're talking the 1970s here. Look at a blaxploitation movie. It wasn't an innocent time. It was a dumbed down time to a certain extent when blockbuster movies were fairly new. And I think the Christopher Reeve did an okay job as a kind of Superman, but I think it's a little bit too white bread for my tastes. And I think the big mistake was Bryan Singer in 2006 trying to continue that. I don't think it plays well in the 21st century. We live in darker and more complex times, and I don't think that a Superman from the 1970s played well to that in a post 9/11 kind of world. But having said that, yeah, we'll see what happens here. I don't mind how many superhero franchises there are out there, as long as they're good. Now, there is a bit of a buzz starting up, by the way, of people, and this is drifting way out of paleo cinema territory, of people who are saying that the superhero movies are, you know, they can see the end of them, they've jumped the shark a little bit, and we'll see how it goes and all that kind of stuff. But I'm kind of hoping that they don't, because I do like superhero movies. I mean, I'm a comics books fan from way back, and I do think that there are a different way of storytelling and a different way of using the CG technology we've got now to tell the stories any way we like. And with that, of course, comes problems, because you then have to choose what to show. If you can imagine everything and bring it to a screen, how do you maintain control of that, and how do you make that within the realms of plausibility? And that's always the big issue with these movies now, is making them at least have an illusion of plausibility about them. But having waffled on about that, I'll get on with the rest of the feedback. I did get an email from Ian Fryer in the UK, a fairly new listener, but he's very enthusiastic. Ian says, "Hi Terry, interestingly, just after I heard you talk about Hudson Hawk on the podcast, it turned up on TV here in the UK. It was half an hour in by then, but I saw enough to get a flavour of the film, which I hadn't seen before. After listening to you and watching Hawk, I was reminded how much I missed the fun side of Bruce Willis. The tone of the film and Willis's performance put me in mind of the more cartoonish elements of his TV show Moonlighting, which I used to love. After seeing Bruce sleepwalk through the last Die Hard movie, looking like he was sucking a lemon, this made a really nice change. Last time I watched the original Die Hard, or Cowboys and Indians in the Towering Inferno, as it is referred by film critic Mark Kermode, I put the trailer on, which has a tagline, 'He's easy to like but hard to kill.' These days he comes across as a miserable bastard who you couldn't kill if you dropped a house on him. Enjoyed hearing about Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet in Mark of Demetrius as well. The influence of their pairing lasted a long time. Gerry Anderson's Supercar had a pair of characters, Master Spy and Zorin, very obviously based on the duo, while his latest Stingray featured Agent X-20, who both looked and sounded like Lorre. Thanks for another great podcast. I'll be back in touch soon." Yeah, thanks, Ian. Sorry I fucked up the reading on that. But yeah, Bruce Willis, I always like Bruce Willis when he doesn't take himself seriously. And I think that the last Die Hard movie we saw as a group, and really, no, it doesn't have the heart. And the thing with the first two movies, at least, was there was a heart to them. And the character was very much the underdog and anything but indestructible. Remember in the first movie where he had to walk across the glass, things like that. And that's really what made the movie work, that every man thing, and you could feel the bruises almost. And I do really appreciate that of that movie, apart from the fact that I once won $500 on a bet on it, as I've mentioned in the podcast before. But I think Willis should embrace his fun side. His little cameo piece in Ocean's 13 had a bit of that, which I kind of liked seeing again. Yeah, Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet are that kind of iconic thing that could be pastiche. I think one of the villains in, was it Danger Mouse? They had a villain that was a lot like Sidney Greenstreet. It's something that's been borrowed on a lot. It's like Orson Welles being the origin of the brain in Pinky and the Brain. There's just so many little homages there for these type of characters. And, Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet, you could always tell, even in serious moments when they were together, they were having a lot of fun with it. And I think that plays well to an audience, even if it is supposedly a serious role, that the joy of interplay between certain actors really enhances a scene, whether it's a serious scene or it's a light scene. That the chemistry isn't something you can predict ahead of time. But when you bring them together, it's just magic to watch. I think that, but getting back to Hudson Hawk, I think Danny Aiello and Willis had that as well, really well. I think that the ensemble in Red, if there's a movie where Bruce Willis isn't taking himself seriously. So maybe there is a bit of that coming up. And Red 2's coming out soon. You've got Malkovich, of course, and you've got Mary Louise Parker, that I've always thought she was hot. And, of course, you've got Helen Mirren with the machine guns, and she's hot. So it does look like I'm going to enjoy Red 2 as much as I did the first one. So that lighter side of Willis, I think he does have a deft touch at comedy. And because the money over the past maybe 20 years of his career has been in the serious stuff, I don't think that's had a chance to come out and play as much as we would like it to. So, and thanks again, Ian, for the feedback. Always appreciated. I did get an email from another guy, some guy that does a podcast. I think his name's Vince. Actually, it was Vince Rotolo from the B-Movie Cast. And he suggested that he and I get together on a Paleo Cinema and do Taxi Driver as one of the movies. So we're trying to line that up at this stage for the next Paleo Cinema podcast. Me and Vince shooting the shit across the Pacific Ocean and the breadth of America about Taxi Driver. So we might have a bit of fun next time around. It's just a matter of negotiating time zones and all that kind of thing. So anyway, that's about it for this time around. It's getting late at night and I need my beauty sleep. Enjoy yourselves. Enjoy the movies you're watching. It is blockbuster movie season, so there should be tons of shit out there to titillate your senses and sensillate your tits. Thank you for listening. And next time around, as I said, I will try to get Vince, and we'll do Taxi Driver as one of the films. I haven't decided which one's going to be my film yet, but I'll throw him a wobble and see if I can find something that might he might enjoy and we might be able to have a bit of fun with. But look after yourselves. Stay out of the hurricanes and the cyclones and whatever else is coming your way. Down here, it's floods at the moment. But look after yourselves, enjoy yourselves, look after each other, and enjoy your movie watching until next time around. Bye.
It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo love. It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dee-Dooby-Doo love. It is such a good night to kiss. It is such a good night to dance. It is such a good night to